When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm a big fan of this film. I think it looks great. I think it sounds great. Fox and Cruz are just really great. They just act off each other really well. It's an amazing film.
Anytime that Cruz and Fox are together in the cab, it's a five-star film for me. Tom Cruise has got like a bit of an overblown Boy Scout who does in really impressive stunts sort of image in his movies. But this was the peak of his awesomeness for me. I don't think he's ever been cooler. Everything about it is flawless. Even the things you could take issue with, I just think no movie does it better.
I'd probably say that this is my favourite Michael Mann film. But yeah, if you've never ever seen it, then what are you doing? Watch it now.
Hey everybody, and welcome to this episode of Flixwatcher Podcast. Today I'm joined by Simon.
Hello, sorry, I was drinking a beer.
Yeah, Simon. Yeah. David.
Hi, man.
Helen.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about Collateral. The one film, is the one film where Tom Cruise is the bad guy?
I think so.
Maybe.
You could definitely argue that...
Interview with the Vampire.
Interview with the Vampire, his character from Magnolia is a bit of a shit. So, you know, like, whether or not you believe he's redeemable is questionable. But yeah, this is his out-and-out villain role, for sure.
Thank you, as always, to the Mighty People for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher. Hello, film fans. Thanks for joining us today. Joining us remotely today, we have David and Simon. If you could please say hello and tell our listeners a little bit more about who you are and what you do, please.
Hi, guys. This is David Trumbull. I've been a political cartoonist and illustrator, but most recently I've been a story artist for animated features. My most recent credits include Henry Selick's first stop-motion movie since Coraline, Wendell and Wild, being produced at Netflix Animation with Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key.
Netflix, you say?
Netflix, indeed, which is why I'm particularly excited to be on this podcast. It's like, yeah, I actually have more than a tangential connection. And currently I'm working on multiple projects in the Dahl universe, the Roald Dahl adaptations that Netflix are scaring up over there in the big tent. If you're looking for me on podcasts, I've been a regular guest on shows that are connected with FlixWatcher, such as Sudden Double Deep, Spotlight, and other podcasts like Easy Riders Raging Podcast, Spielberg Pod, Bygones, and recently Caged In.
They're not joined us yet, but they will.
They're welcome. Bring them on.
They have said...
All part of the Gaggling group, yes.
It is, yeah. London podcast people generally. Who are you on the other side of the screen?
I'm Simon Williams. My CV is not nearly as impressive as that. I have very little connection to the film industry, except that I and a friend of mine run the Bigger Boat film quiz. You're going to need a bigger boat down in London. Well, various venues. We've been doing that for about, I think we just had our 16th birthday. Whoa. So I think we're slightly vaguely connected through that. Otherwise, in my day job, I work in medical communications. So that can be quite heavy going. So it's nice to have the quiz to fall back on. Although, obviously, because of COVID, we are currently on a bit of a hiatus.
And I think our regular listeners would certainly have heard us talking about a Bigger Boat film quiz, not least because this is where Helen and I met under the auspices of Shabbos Rollers, which is... helmed by Ben Dads, who brought it all together under Twitter helm. And so, and all the podcasts that Dave mentioned before, Sunday Double Deep, Easy Rider Raging Podcast, and Spotlight, they all are represented at Bigger Boat Film Quiz. So there is a lot of connection to films. And also we know a lot of you get a lot of film journalists, like the guys from Empire and BBC and stuff like that. So you have your fans there. In the film industry, tangentially.
Yeah, we have quite a few. I think the Empire guys now have not been for a while. They're too famous. They just get too much hassle. yeah, we've had a few real celebs. Littlefinger from Game of Thrones.
Amazing.
Aidan Gillen.
Very same. That's quite a few years ago now. Charlie Higson. This was when we started off at the Boogaloo in Highgate.
Yeah.
It's a very trendy pub, probably a bit too trendy for us.
That's my local now, actually.
Is it?
It is. Can you come back?
It'd be awesome. Say hi to Jerry from us. it's a great pub. It used to be my local too, but obviously I've moved up north now.
Enfield.
Oh, I see. It's a London joke.
You know, Simon, you say it's not particularly like as impressive, but like I will tell you that your quiz has passed into legend for me all the way over here in America. Like all of my mates and my brother speak volumes about it. So the only reason why I've never showed up at the Bigger Boat is just because I'm in Des Moines, Iowa.
Well,
otherwise I'd totally be there.
It's not a good enough excuse. We had a team from ILM came to our quiz once.
Holy shit.
You may not believe this. This was several years back, but they were apparently doing something in Scotland. They came down to London to do our quiz at the Boogaloo.
That's amazing.
Wow. No, we did. We'd get some pretty good coverage over the years. Did I mention Charlie Higson? That was another celeb.
Yeah, from the Fast Show.
Yeah, but otherwise, you're good sales.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I do miss the quiz and all things to do with films that aren't just on Netflix, because I'm looking forward to the cinemas. As we record this, the cinemas come back in just over 10 days in the UK, and I cannot wait.
Yeah, I feel like I want to cry just even hearing that.
Rub yourself against the seats, luxurious seats.
Is that? I didn't use it. Well, I don't know. You do the cinema. That's not why. That's not my jam there.
I got thrown out of my local for that.
Anyway, talking about films, we're here to talk about Collateral, which is your choice, David. Can you tell us why you chose Collateral and give us a synopsis in less than 1 minute?
Okay, so Collateral is just your quintessential page-turning film set in one night. I'm a big fan of those types of movies. Directed in 2004 by Michael Mann, it sees this lowly taxi driver, Max, portrayed by Jamie Foxx. He picks up a fare, which is Tom Cruise with a Richard Gere salt-and-pepper beard, Vincent, dressed like he came out of Michael Mann's Heat. He offers him a lot of money to take him to five different stops over the night, and it becomes very clear on the first ride that Vincent is a hitman picking off witnesses on a list, and it just becomes a cat and mouse game, a battle of wits between these two guys as they drive around Los Angeles. And so I kind of felt like choosing this because the other episode we're going to do, not to give anything away, is another action movie. And I felt like these two movies exist on either end of the spectrum of what an action movie can be, but both in awesome, legitimate ways. I remember watching this when it first came out. I was in film school, and it just hit me at like the exact perfect moment in my life. I was a film student. I desperately wanted to like be in engrossed in cinema. And there was a period like in the years following where it just lived rent-free in my head just because of the way it was filmed, because of Tom Cruise's performance. The use of DV, like HD, digital, to record video, Los Angeles, yeah. It just wowed me because as a film student, it suddenly, despite being this massive budget movie with a really bankable star, it was this movie where filmmaking felt democratized to me because I could grab a digital film camera and go run out into the night and film in a real location. So it just inspired me. It chimed with other movies I'd seen shot on digital around that time, like Chelsea Walls by Ethan Hawke. And it definitely informed quite a few of the short films I made in film school and beyond. So I hadn't watched it in many years. And when I saw that it was on Netflix, it just really climbed up the list really quickly. Of like, oh, I really want to see if this movie still stands up.
So you've only seen it once?
Oh, no, I've seen it. I wore the DVD out when I first... I just haven't watched it in probably 10 years.
That's so what it's kind one of happens, though, isn't it? You just kind of... You just like lose touch with the DVD and it's like, oh, I don't have access to this anymore.
I mean, you know, back in the day where you bought a DVD, you watched all the extras, you listened to the commentary, like there used to be a real tradition to, you know, a ritual to watching DVDs. And now because of the way movies stream, it's like that's all been lost. And there was a particular like trepidation going back to it because, you know, you see a movie that you absolutely love and you become obsessed with every single little detail about it. And then it disappears from your life for a very long time. And so when I was revisiting it, I was like, God, I really hope that it's as good as I remember it. Like maybe it's aged, you know, differently or I've changed or something. So it was very interesting, but that was why I picked it.
Simon, where are you with Collateral?
Love it. Seen it several times. I was so happy when, you know, I was told this was the choice of film. I'm pretty sure I saw it at the cinema. And I think, well, I mean, we'll get into this, but I think the small screen, it almost benefits from that kind of that graininess, you know, that DV now that's some people say it's not aged very well. I think it still looks wonderful. Mm. It's, you know, you called it a quintessential one night movie. It's a quintessential LA movie.
Yeah.
The way they just roam back and forth across LA. I mean, you know, Michael Mann is obviously famous for the way he films cities at night. Mm. It's a beautiful film. It's, you know, for a film that sums up a city, it's also, it's quite focused as well. Quite a small group of characters that all, they come together in a very natural way as well. As it, there's not, we'll talk about it in a bit, but there's lesser films would rely on, you know, coincidences and contrivances, but the way they deal with those, the reasons these characters come into each other's orbits is just very well done. Mm. You know, massive Tom Cruise fan, watching this film again just cemented that for me.
Mm. I don't think he's ever been cooler than in this movie. I mean, and like Tom Cruise has got like a bit of an overblown Boy Scout who does in really impressive stunts sort of image in his movies. But this was him like probably like the peak of his awesomeness for me. Like,
this is before he went, he dialed it to 11 with the Mission Impossible films, wasn't it? Because he was kind of, this is kind of stage where he doubled his toe into trying to make awards worthy films, but they just didn't resonate. He just kind of went, fuck it.
I'm just, it was around, know, the time he grew the crazy beard for Last Samurai, and everyone was like, will they give Tom Cruise a beard Oscar? You know, an Oscar just for having a beard, you know what I mean? And then like, once that nonsense was over with, he really, you know, stayed true to himself and went full Mission Impossible.
Well, we'll dive into Tom Cruise in a bit, I'm sure, and the rest of the cast. But, Helen, I know you're a fan of Collateral. Is it purely because of your one man who you mentioned in every single episode, who in this case has a ponytail? The Ruffalo.
I mean, Mark Ruffalo is excellent in it, but there are many other things which have already been mentioned. I'm a big fan of this film. I think it looks great. I think it sounds great. Fox and Cruise are just really great. They just act off each other really well. I love Tom Cruise's suit in this. I just think it's an amazing film and really enjoyed watching it again. And yeah, there's just something about it. It's kind of like a weird period in Tom Cruise where he was just kind of like making really, really interesting films and doing something a little bit different. And it kind of made me a little bit nostalgic for that Tom Cruise. But yeah, no, I really enjoyed revisiting it and had originally seen it in the cinema. And I think I must have seen it maybe once or twice after that, but I hadn't seen it for a very, very long time. So a very welcome return to it for me.
Yeah, I can understand why this is a lot of people's favourite film for Tom Cruise. For me, he's always just a very, he's a stable actor. But the thing that sets him apart generally for me is how he interacts with the whole production and people. He's got his kind of weird personal problems, but people who work on the films all absolutely love working with him because he works so hard. He's amiable. Every single time I've heard a story about Tom Cruise, I was speaking to a friend who works at Pitch House Central Cinema, and Tom Cruise came in and he shook every single person's hand who worked at cinema and said, "Hi, I'm Tom Cruise," as if like, you don't know who he is. You work in the cinema, you don't know who Tom Cruise is, but he's that kind of, but smaller people give you the short shrift. And it's things like that which make him a movie star over and above his acting. And I think his acting in this is probably the best.
It's super like dialed down and subtle. His voice is really low. He's very focused. And I think to chime off of what you guys are saying, like he comes across as a very generous actor because like he's playing the villain to Jamie Foxx, and Jamie Foxx is delivering a star-making turn. So it's great to see like an actor of Cruise's mega wattage, like really letting Foxx like own the stage for so much of the film. It's really genuinely a two-hander. It's not just like one star propping up the whole film. It's a star and a star in the wings. And it's funny because there is a lot of ridiculous around Tom Cruise. Like there's a lot of furore around him. I mean, my family over here is Jewish. And I think my favorite Tom Cruise interaction I ever had with them was like, I just mentioned Tom Cruise to one of my girlfriend's Jewish friends. And she just went, "Oh, mashugana." And like that's all you need to know about him. He's a little crazy, but like so far, like that's just created really, really entertaining cinema. And he's just relentlessly entertaining because he's so consistent in his intention to entertain you. And yeah. and as far as that's concerned, on the mainstream stage, there's probably very few people who can boast that many results.
I was going to say, to me, he's the last of the kind of the A-list stars, the sort of person whose name above the title is enough. You know, now we're in the era of the franchise, and no actor is bigger than the franchise that they star in. They can be replaced, but you know, Tom Cruise, you know, the days of, you know, Willis, Stallone, and Schwarzenegger is gone. But you know, Cruise is probably the last holdout of that old fashioned movie star. And what you're saying about his professionalism, you just know he brings his A game every time. Sorry, it's a bit of a cliche. He takes it very seriously, you know. And yeah, he'll go to where people are hanging out outside the premieres, and you see him, and he just systematically goes through, and it will shake every person's hand, and it will be late into the film. I'm sure I've heard about premieres that have been delayed because Cruise is outside shaking every single person's hand who's been waiting there for hours. Yeah, massive fan. Yeah,
he's really, he's got a lot of menschiness to him, you know what I mean? Yeah.
To use another Jewish phrase. Yeah, it doesn't seem contrived as well, because it's easy to fall on that side. You think, oh, you're a bit of a tryhard. I think it does come naturally to him, and I think he just does work really hard. But I think for me, you know, when I saw this, I've only seen this twice now, but for me, it's like Jamie Foxx came out of this. I was like, who the fuck is this guy? He's brilliant. And then I see him in Ray. So he's got the musical chops. He's got the comedic chops. For me, he's a more interesting actor than Tom Cruise, but still, you know, there's reasons why Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise.
Well, I think it's telling that Jamie Foxx's character, Max, Jamie Foxx is an obviously incredibly charismatic, handsome, funny, well-built gentleman, but he manages to convince you that he's this taxi driver who is stuck in this rut and has never been able to get his business off the ground and is a loser, frankly. His biggest achievement is that he keeps his cab clean. And Tom Cruise, conversely, like, you know, I don't buy Tom Cruise as a working man in War of the Worlds, for example, because he's Tom Cruise. The moment the aliens attack, he goes into fucking Ethan Hunt running mode and T-1000's his way down the street. It's like, I wouldn't have bought Tom Cruise in the Max role. I only buy Tom Cruise as Vincent, because to play Vincent you need an icon, because he is just he's just, when it gets to the last act where he's just like the velociraptor from Jurassic Park stalking Jada Pinkett Smith, like, you need an actor of his,
that's a nice
of
analogy his, that actually, yeah, yeah.
Like, you need an actor of his like stature to allow a character like Max and Jamie Foxx to rise up against him. You know, it's a genuine threat, and that makes it a real treat cinematically.
It's a shame in a lot of people who review this film, they do focus on Cruise for obvious reasons, and it's a bit of a novelty that he's an out-and-out bad guy. But I think there's a risk that you kind of miss the subtlety of this. Just, hey, Fox is the one that develops through the film. He has the arc, and, you know, he almost absorbs some of Vincent's badassness, the great scene in the club where he goes in there, he's stuttering and he's about to get shot. And then he just suddenly becomes Vincent, and he just channels him so beautifully. And then he just swaggers out at the club.
Manages to intimidate Javier Bardem. Like, that's no mean feat, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting. You're right, because, like, Tom Cruise's role is obviously a lot more still and focused than Fox's arc. But, like, Cruise's character is, like, Vincent is, like, slowly fragmenting, like, subtly as the story goes along. And he lets a little bit of vulnerability out, only for it to completely go back inside himself by the end. And it's kind of like a fascinating reverse Stockholm syndrome, where like the kidnapper starts to assume a relationship with the person he's kidnapped. You know, the person he's holding at gunpoint. He starts to like think that him and Jamie Foxx are friends, you know, and then feels genuinely wounded when Foxx, you know, crashes the car, and then he goes
you
full on
Javier inside about them. The Helen, like, do you talk about a few of the other
so yeah, it's
cameos
very subtle work
this.
From Cruise.
Well, the one I always forget is Jason Statham at the start, which apparently people like to say he's Frank from Crank. That's you know, because he's kind of like uncredited, but you know, that's his kind of character. And just to say, apparently Russell Crowe and Adam Sandler were originally sort of in line to play these characters. So we could have been having a very, very different conversation.
In line to play who?
The Vincent. And,
I believe Crowe was going to be Vincent and Adam Sandler was going to be Max.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Glad that didn't happen.
Just remember, in those days, Russell Crowe was a lot more slimline.
and obviously Sandler proved with stuff like Uncut Gems that he can turn in a brilliant performance. If he had played like his character from Punch Drunk Love, like the stuttering guy with a little bit of darkness in him, maybe it would have worked. But I think it's interesting what you just said, because like the thing that stood out the most to me on this rewatch is I understand a little bit about the history of how the movie was made, which is that obviously it's from a script by, I think, Stuart Beattie.
He was 17 when he wrote it.
Yeah, like, exactly. Mad. He wrote it like...
Wow.
And it's fascinating because Beattie, you know, his filmography since then has been pretty checkered. Like, I think he directed I, Frankenstein and stuff. And looking at the script, I know that Michael Mann heavily rewrote an awful lot of it because he comes in with this incredibly disciplined, like, research-based sort of, like, approach whereby he, you know, fleshes out each of the characters, gives them backstories and works with them religiously with the cast. And so... this time, more than any other time, I was aware of like the two screenplays within the movie jostling for attention because there's a version of Stuart Beattie's script which feels like if it had been directed by anybody else, like say if Tony Scott had directed this with John Travolta was actually in line to play Vincent at one point. If you had seen a John Travolta, Denzel Washington led Tony Scott version of Collateral, it would have been just fine. Like, it would have been, like, maybe a 3-star or something. Like you can see this.
It would have been a lot of people's favourite films.
Exactly. If a lot of workmen, like...
It would have been very loud. I can see it being very, very loud.
It would have still been one of my favourite films.
No, I mean, like, hey, I love a Tony Scott movie, but, like, it would have felt a bit like taking a Pelham 1-2-3. It would have had, like, nothing to fault its style or its craft, mm-hmm. but it wouldn't have reached, like, the transcendence that Mann does. And so watching this movie again, like... I saw moments in the script where, I mean, Simon mentioned that, like, you know, other movies rely on a lot more contrivances. It's actually really fascinating how many contrivances Collateral gets away with because of its incredible style. Because think about it. If your entire third act hinges upon the biggest coincidence in the world, which is that Jada Pinkett Smith and Tom Cruise got into the same cab. You know, the fact that Max realizes the final hit on Vincent's list is the lawyer who just gave him her number, you know? Like, in any movie, that could break the audience's suspension of disbelief. And so you'd think that they would play it a little safer with other contrivances in the story, but, like, there's actually a lot of things that happen in the plot that feel a bit like they stretch credulity. Like, when you go to the hospital to see Max's mother, Mark Ruffalo gets in the elevator with them, and it's just like this random moment where he doesn't realize that he's got the people that he's tracking in the elevator with him, and then he leaves. Mm. And then a bunch of the other things that, like, you know, when I think about if it had been made by a different director, you would have bought some of the more contrived things as being like, oh, this is just a silly action movie. Like, you know, for example, like, I don't know if I would believe that Max would leave his mother in a hospital room with a guy who he literally just saw kill three people in front of him, you know? And then things like the idea that a high-powered lawyer would give her number to a cabbie, you know, like, who, as charming as Jamie Foxx is, you know what I mean?
He's a very good cabbie.
He's a very good cabbie, but it speaks a lot to just how classy and excellently produced this movie is, that it kind of papers over all these things that in another movie I would have been like, bullshit. But because you're so carried along by it, it just immerses you and you kind of just let it all slide.
I buy the card giving. I buy it. Like, yeah, Jamie Foxx is hot. Yeah,
I will defer to you on that for sure.
I want to take exception to the idea that it papers over. I think it puts in the work. I mean, the main coincidence that you mentioned about them both getting in the same cab, that was in my head actually when I started the film. And it had been a while since I'd watched it, but I have watched it several times before. And I was thinking, it's ridiculous. What are the chances? Mm. But they set it up absolutely perfectly. It's completely feasible.
Well, he's scoping out the building, isn't he? Yeah.
He's already in the same building. He's just dropped. And not only, he doesn't just get in the cab, he almost doesn't get in the cab because...
It's brilliant, yeah.
Because Max he's doing something else. Is he looking at his brochure or something? Or he's looking at his postcard?
Or he's like still dazed with the fact that he just got Jada Pinkett Smith's number.
Well, yeah, that as well. Yeah, exactly. So he actually walks away and he's about to get in another cab. And then he goes like, oh, no, come back. And it's that kind of sliding doors moment where just think how his night could have gone if he'd have let him go.
And also there's that double take as they're crossing on the elevators, on the escalators, where the camera catches Cruise look at her but doesn't notice it. So I think it does do the, as Simon says, it puts the work in to make the payoff.
It sort of rests just on the right side of so strange that it could have happened.
And I think that's why the first time you watch this, you're like, when you find out that's where it's going, you're like, holy fuck, I can. And you do the kind of usual suspects Kobayashi thing to you do all the working out to go back to that point. You're like, yeah, it does work, it's fine, it all makes sense. And
Even Ruffalo being at the hospital, he would go to the morgue to find out if the person, his informant that went missing, turned up in the morgue.
Yeah.
Like that is actually a logical reason why he would be there. Yeah. It's just in another movie it would have felt contrived, but in this movie you just buy it because, like you said, they did the work.
Yeah, that I would say that's more of a contrivance because there must be so many hospitals in LA, and those bodies could have gone to any of those hospitals and just happens to go to the same one. But I actually made a note of that. I love the moment. That's the point at which this story about this huge city suddenly coalesces around these three people who were in the lift at that one moment.
Yeah.
And then nothing really happens then. And then they don't come back later until do they interact before the club?
No, I think Ruffalo's character is interesting because he basically occupies a role that is kind of a staple of action movies. It's kind of the Scatman Crothers in The Shining, Richard Farnsworth in Misery, like the cop who senses what the real story is and then arrives to be like a decoy savior just before the third act and then gets blown away. So
that's
like
such a great analogy. Yeah,
it's brilliant. He occupies this wonderful sort of like role of like this little olive branch of hope that Max's nightmare will end, and then Max has this sort of like deja vu moment of having to get forced back into the taxi with Cruz, and you know
the way the Cruz just pulls him in, he's like, come on, let's go, as if like he thinks he's done him a massive favor.
He thinks he's doing his a favor, isn't he thinks he's saving him from him. It's a great shock moment, that and I love the ups and downs of Cruz's behavior, where at one point you're almost on his side. You know, he's kind of the brilliant bit where he pretends to be a district attorney and he has a go at the guy's dispatcher and just massacres him.
He helps out Max,
but then he saves Max in the Fever nightclub as well. There's that moment where he kills Felix's own men, the men who hired him to save Max from a bullet, and then he gives Max this really like hurt look of like damn you, I don't know how to quit you, Max. It's like it's very much like a twisted love story in Vincent's head. Yeah. You could read it as a love story with a tragic end.
I tell you what, there was one aspect of it that I hadn't remembered from my previous watching, and it was the story that Mark Ruffalo, is he Fanning? I can't remember what he's called. He mentions about another story about a cab driver who was accused of murders. That had completely gone out of my brain. And so you realize, for all the cool stuff that Tom Cruise does and where he saves him in the alleyway and shoots those three guys. And at the back of your mind, you're thinking he's going to kill him at the end of this night. That's his plan. Even though we think he's helping him and he's giving him confidence. And then we know he's still going to tie off those loose ends at the end.
Or you do see him wrestling with that potentiality. Like when he kills Daniel, the jazz man, which is just an incredible scene, you know. One of the virtues of a movie that's set over one night, Michael Mann said that he loves the fact that the script felt like the third act of a big movie. You know, it was like Michael Mann does a lot of sprawling epics, and this was like such a focused film, as you say, Simon, like that you get to spend a lot of time with these character beats, you know, longer scenes than you might get away with in another film, you know. And so you get these little subtle moments of like cracks in Cruise's cold exterior. Like, you can tell that Vincent loved jazz as a child. You know, Cruz and Mann came up with this whole backstory about it being his link to his abusive father. And so then, you know, as he goes along, he starts to identify Max as being like on his team. And so you get the feeling that his plan is to kill him, but that he actually is almost like talking himself out of it as he goes along. It's like, it's someone who's so close to a nervous breakdown and they just don't know it. Which is fascinating to see in Cruz's face, because he manages to look both blank and completely like incapable of emotion, and yet there's so much emotion in him.
Before we head to the scores, then, do you think, and this is an open question for anyone then, had it gone to plan for Vincent's character, would Max have ended up just dead at the end of it?
Yes, I think so. I think it's definitely one of those like plots where if you think about it, Cruz is like the shark from Jaws, but it's like if the shark from Jaws developed a conscience halfway through. and I said that he was a bit like the velociraptor at the end, but that's because he's been so like weirdly hurt by Max's betrayal in quotation marks.
It's kind of weird
that he's gone
like
back inside himself.
It's a false betrayal, isn't it? Because he's like, oh, man, I'm going to kill this guy anyway, but he's like, oh, he's making it so much. Oh.
I think he'd kill him, but I think he'd feel really bad about it.
Yeah.
I think he'd have to kill him because
he knows
this guy,
much.
Max, yeah, he knows everything. So what happened? Well, I picked him up. He got off this plane And then I was there outside a building. A man fell onto my cab. He dispatched him this way. He'd be able to like lay out so in no uncertain terms he could identify.
Met the crime boss, yeah. Felix, who's in charge of everything.
Yeah.
Well, there's too much.
Yeah, there's that brilliant moment after the first victim's fallen on the car. I'm not sure this is the moment. And he says, just take the car. I promise I won't say anything. He goes, what, you promise?
Yeah.
And he gives him that little glimmer of hope. And he's like, get in the fucking car.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing we haven't mentioned yet, which is that it's definitely Michael Mann's funniest film. It's got a lot of wit in it and a lot of levity.
Which Tom Cruise's funniest film.
Probably is, you know. I mean, like, you know, I think I personally find Frank T.J. Mackey hilarious as much as he is shocking. But yeah, Cruise has got a natural knack for humor, but him and Fox together, it's like jazz watching them.
Should we head to the scores, guys?
Hello, folks. I'm Sam.
And I'm Martin.
And every week for the last 5 years, we've got together to talk about the musician Tom Waits.
He's a gravelly voice singer that sounded like he doused his vocal cords in bourbon and set fire to them with a cigarette and wrote such classic songs as Way Down in the Hole, Downtown Train, Jersey Girl.
He's also the gravelly voiced actor from films such as The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Seven Psychopaths, both of which coincidentally are on Netflix and both of which Kobe and Helen have discussed here on FlixWatcher.
So make sure you check those episodes out. And when you have a little bit of a taste for the magic that is Tom Waits, why not head over to songbysongpodcast.com or search for Song by Song in your podcatcher of choice to listen to a little bit more about Tom Waits.
Welcome to the FlixWatcher scores. All of our scores are out of 5. You may have decimal places if you wish, and we will start with you, please, David, with your recommendability.
I think it should be no surprise to anyone. This is a 5 for me, for no other reason that I have recommended this movie to pretty much anyone who will listen, just like, especially when it first came out. But like, you know, even now I would consider, like, looking at it from a storyboard artist's eye, now that I've worked animation, like I was a little bit more aware of some of the story contrivances this time, but it really doesn't matter just because this is my cinematic sweet spot, you know, real locations, really, really in-depth character scenes. I love heightened movies that are really authentically made and tactile, but they're still genre pieces because genre is where some of the most exciting, you know, cinematic moments can come out of. And, you know, there are just moments where the style and performances reach this sort of transcendence and it just carries you along. The score, the fact that, like, it's tried to say, but LA is a character in this movie. You know, it's the way it was filmed was really revolutionary. Like, you know, shows like 24 had already shot on digital at night. But, like, there was something revelatory about watching a movie that big with that big a star shot on that medium and being like, holy shit, it's as cinematic as anything. And any time that Cruise and Fox are together in the cab, it's a 5-star film for me. You know, I mean, we mentioned how, you know, Ruffalo is a real chameleon, you know, especially around that time before he became synonymous with, like, the Hulk and stuff. But, like, in theory, you could cut out all of Fanning and the cops and the feds scenes and shoot it entirely from Max's perspective and you still wouldn't be lost because whenever Max figures something out, it still makes sense. So you could do a 90 minutes or less podcast of like a shorter version of this movie and you wouldn't necessarily lose anything. But just
I think that rug pull though is still one of the best parts of the film.
It is. Like, exactly. It's one of those things where like you end up with this, as Simon put it, like this global view of the city, and then it becomes about just these two men with Ruffalo as the wild card in there. So yeah, like it's a 5. So, I mean, like it's
5.
Everything about it is flawless. Even the things you could take issue with, I just think no movie does it better.
Simon,
yeah, easy for me. It's another 5. It's an art house action movie. Michael Mann doing what he does best: cities at night, people moving around them. You know, you've got the core characters, you've got these random interactions, just the wild nature of the city as well. The bit where he screams for help, he's handcuffed to the steering wheel and those guys just see him and you see them like predators moving around and then they realize they meet a bigger predator. And Tom Cruise just does that ultimate. There are videos on YouTube dedicated to the way Tom Cruise quick draws and kills those guys
before they can even blink. In like academies, like actually real police officers have used that video as evidence of how to pull your gun and shoot someone.
It may well be. I mean, I think as I was watching it, I was thinking I agree with you that this is probably the coolest he's ever been. Jack Reacher is maybe a close second. The, you know, when people joke about Tom Cruise's limited stature, that goes out the window, because you believe he can take these people. I mean, it's a bit different in this. He does a bit of hand-to-hand stuff, but, you know, he's quick on the draw. He's a great shot. You can believe he would, you know, cut a sway through the city if he had to. So, yeah, easy five for me.
Helen?
I'm also going to join the five party. I watched Heat recently, and I was a little bit disappointed. I did not have the rip-roaring time that I seem to remember. So I was a little bit apprehensive watching this, thinking, oh, no, is it going to be as good as it is? And I still really enjoy this, and I'd probably say that this is my favourite Michael Mann film by a lot. But, yeah, if you've never, ever seen it, then what are you doing? Watch it now.
I don't think I would have given Heat or a lot of other Michael Mann, like The Insider, I don't think I would have given those movies a five on recommendability, because some of them are really dense and hard to have like a jumping on point, whereas Collateral is like lean and totally like all killer, no filler. You know,
I think you guys convinced me here to go for five. I wasn't going to go for five, but I think I'm going to drop in there. Because it flows nicely. It's easy to watch. And the two stars, like I say, whether you're a fan of Tom Cruise or not, you can't deny the presence he has in this. And for me, the breakout being Jamie Foxx in this, for me, absolutely fantastic. Repeat viewing score, David.
Compared to other Michael Mann movies, I gave this like probably like a 4.9. I think that the best way I could describe it to people when it comes to how easy it is to watch and rewatch. It's like that line Max says about Island Limos. To me, the movie is more than just a ride. It's like a club experience, cool groove. You don't want it to end. It's like a movie that, like, because it's just these two heavy hitters in a cab driving, and because the plot is so linear, it's like, okay, who the hell are you at math? I have five hits. We've got to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You just go from one set piece to the next. You can rewatch this movie so easily, and hell, you could go into it halfway through and not get lost, because you know they're just in a car going on this linear journey to the end. So yeah, I'd say repeat viewing scores is immense, because I used to rewatch this movie like on the reg, and now that I've watched it again, I can see why.
Simon,
I'm gonna go for another five. I've watched this several times. I enjoyed it this time. I would say at least maybe the eighth time I've seen it, I enjoyed it just as much as I did the first time. It's a 2-hour film. It feels like a 90-minute film. It's just so slick. You know, if I had any criticism, it's maybe the fact that it turns into a slasher movie at the end. But I like slasher movies, so that's why it's
the panic room thing. It does the panic room thing where, you know, you have all the Fincher amazing shots, and then it's just people scrambling for a gun at the end. You know?
And you don't know who got shot in that final.
It's specifically the moment where he jumps on the train. And you see the train heading off with him on the back.
It is, he's like, yeah, proper.
He's the Stalker killer.
You almost want the Velociraptor breath to hit the glass of the train before he uses the door. Let's just hope Tom Cruise doesn't figure out how to open doors.
I wanted him to pop out a talon from his feet and from his shoes, and go tuk 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 on the.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned that ending. The ending is really. It is like a thriller. Like, they lose the cab. It's like at the end of Speed when they lose the bus. And it's like, okay, where's Speed got to go now that the bus is gone? And once you leave the cab, it's like, okay, it's gonna become a more standard thriller. But because Michael Mann is so detailed and he makes every one of Vincent's actions while he's stalking them really, really legitimately clever. Like, Cruise dims all the lights. He walks into this room. There's those incredible shots of just him walking to this darkened office like a specter. And then he quietens down to hear just the ambient noise of the room so he can pick up where Jada Pinkett Smith is like creeping. And then like even jumping onto the train, you see him, you never lose what Vincent's thought process is. Even when he's on the train, he gets off to point his gun at where he knows they are, just to see if they're going to get off the train. And then
for me is like the biggest heart-stopping bit in the film.
It's done with the precision of a soldier, you know, an ex-special forces guy, you know.
It's the reaction of Jada Pinkett and Max at the same time. They know what he's doing, and he looks through, he's like, oh, for fuck. And already you can see the calculations in the head every single stop.
Yeah. So it is a standard ending, but it's just so well done. So it makes up for it.
Helen, repeat viewing score.
I'm going to give it a 4. I think this is the second time I've watched it this year, which probably quite high for this. I don't think I'll be returning to it many more times this year. Even with it being an hour and 59 minutes, it doesn't quite feel like that. And I think it is just because the bits in the taxi and the kind of time between the first few kills is so short that it is just bam, bam, bam. And you're in there and you're in that taxi and you're just like, who's going to die next, basically. So yeah, I'm going to go for a 4 on repeat viewing.
I'm going to go for 2.5. This is the second time I've seen it ever. And I remember thinking, I love it when there's a good couple of rug pulled and the, not a twist, but the turn up at the end where he's got to go back and save Jada Pinkett because that's who Vincent's after. Once those were said, you know, once those kind of seeded in my brain from the start of the film, it takes away the fun for me. So I think, you know, after, I can't remember when I watched it the first time, but you know, a good 10 or so years later, it was good to get back to it again. So yeah, 2.5, small screen score, David.
Okay, so this one I did go down to a 4 for maybe unexpected reasons, which is like, okay, so yeah, it is shot on digital. Digital's now become all the rage. Like now it's a standard thing to film nighttime scenes with digital because, you know, you can pick up so much lower light levels, yeah. You know. A shot that pans from, like that pulls focus from Tom Cruise's close-up to Jamie Foxx in the parking lot down below, like you could never achieve that on film. And so at the time it was revolutionary. And so, yeah, this movie, you could watch this movie on your phone. In fact, I think Quibi, before it died, you know, invested a lot of money in like one of those series that was like a page turner series, which I think also revolved around like a passenger from hell kind of action movie that just unfolds a bit like Collateral. And I feel like you could, in theory, watch Collateral like that. However, I'm going to give it a 4 because I don't want it to be watched on those smaller screens. I think it's a shame to think, oh, because it's not necessarily like an IMAX movie that you shouldn't enjoy it in the cinema. In the cinema, it was one of the most immersive, amazing experiences I've ever had watching a movie. So, you know, it's...
I mean, and just to be clear, when we talk about small screen, we talk about the home viewing experience. Mm-hmm. So people go, well, I've got a 70-inch TV at home. It's still small screen compared to, you know, that's how you watch Netflix is at home. But yeah,
it makes for a good home viewing experience. But I wish it could be enjoyed more in like on the biggest screen you can, and it shouldn't be just because it's in I don't know digital and just because it's early digital. It still feels really cinematic to me.
Simon,
well, I'm going to make working out this average very easy because I'm going to go 5. I've seen this in the cinema. I've seen this on TVs of increasing size over the years, and I watched it this time on the laptop, and I loved it equally each time. I mean, obviously you got the big Michael Mann helicopter shots over LA that looked epic at the cinema, but to me it doesn't lose anything on the small screen at all.
Helen.
So I don't know whether it's just our extended break from not having cinemas for over a year now, but I was feeling particularly nostalgic for wanting to watch this again at the cinema. That said, I did enjoy the 2 rewatches at home. I think maybe more for me is there's just so much going on with the sound as well, that to have it in a cinema would really amplify some of the music going on, because there's quite a lot of different music in it, and it all kind of goes along with each kind of pacing
really nice,
of the story, like the really kind of romantic, soft kind of like jazzy moments to the kind of like pounding, like dance music in the club and everything.
Clubs. Yeah.
That's actually a fantastic point, because there are certain lines that are really subtle and almost mumbled, and the mix, you lose it a bit in the mix on a laptop. Like even the line, I'm collateral anyway, you barely hear when they come out of the jazz bar. So I think you're right. Yeah.
I mean, you can watch it and then have a lovely time at home. But I think for me, I'm going to give it a 4 because I would like to see it on the cinema again, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in with the 4 as well. I think it'd be good to watch it in the cinema, but I've only ever watched it at home, and I've enjoyed it both times. So, but I think the soundscape and the sound effects and the score would be the things that would augment it for me rather than the screen experience itself. And I know a lot's been made about the cinematography here, and it being shot on DV, and I think that makes it slightly more televisual but not that doesn't really take away from it at all. Engagement score, David.
I'm very engaged by this movie from the very beginning. From the moment that Jamie Foxx closes the door of the cab and the music just goes doom, doom. Like the score just like signifies that once he gets into his cab, he's in his like calm place. And then just like the movie never really releases you from the moment he drives off. I mean, even the first like 10, 15 minutes where it's just him having a delightful ride with Annie, just like Jada Pinkett Smith, we haven't mentioned her very much, except as a plot device. But like, she's really charming in this story. You really do buy, even though like I don't necessarily know whether a high-powered district attorney would give her number to a cabbie. She does sell it because there's great chemistry between them. And when Tom Cruise gets in the cab, it's almost like if you didn't know from the trailers and whatnot what the movie was going to be, you could have been forgiven for thinking that this was going to be a really interesting LA set ensemble drama about different rides that get into Jamie Foxx's cab, you know, until the body, you know, falls on the car and the other shoe literally drops, you know, it seems like it's going to be a different type of film, but it's engaging. Even when it changes gears, like I was engrossed from just learning who Max was. And then when Cruise comes in, it just, the badassery gets amped up to 11. I gave it an engagement score of about 4.5, because I did have to turn off the movie twice when I watched it to go do something. And I think because I now know the plot and because of the fact that there's a lot of scenes in cars and stuff like that, I didn't feel too bad pausing it and going and attending to an errand or whatnot. So yeah, but then again, I don't think being able to turn off a movie and then come back to it is necessarily a bad thing. It just meant that the movie's really, you know, takes you along in a very cool way and you don't feel lost. You don't feel like you're going to have a problem getting back into it. Like another Michael Mann movie. Like, if I left halfway through The Insider, I would be completely lost. You know, God forbid I ever do that with, Miami Vice. I'd be absolutely lost. I'd have to start again.
Well, we've got a new baby in our house and we are absolutely shattered. And I haven't watched an entire film all the way through for, I would say, several weeks, and this is the first time I've watched an entire film in one go. I couldn't stop it. It just invigorated me. I was watching it on the laptop with my headphones, so all the comments you made about the sound, it was fantastic. In fact, there was one bit, the bit where he shoots those the would-be muggers, and it's just this massive, not the ridiculous over-the-top Hollywood gunshots that you often hear. It sounded like shot just ricocheting off buildings in it, you know, in the downtown district or wherever they are. The sound was fantastic. I would have to give it a 5.
Helen.
Yeah. It's kind of hard because obviously I've seen it recently before this and I was more kind of making notes, but the time before that, after my kind of break and the first time, completely engaged in it, even though you kind of towards the end you can kind of sort of see where it might sort of be going a little bit. I think I'm going to give it a 5 actually. It's really rewarding to kind of pay attention to all the sort of kind of like the bigger details and the smaller details, like there's things that, like the when the coyote runs across the road, which I'd completely forgotten about happened, and there's just like kind of like those really wild moments that if you're kind of looking at your phone, you're not going to see because they're not like really loud and you're going to miss them, and they all kind of add up to everything. So yeah, 5.
I'm gonna go for 5 as well. I think it's mainly as a result of not really remember how the film plays out. And I think it was right at the start seeing Jason Statham down as like, hold on, is Jason Statham in this film? And the answer is no. But, you know, it's that kind of thing, that kind of interest that pulled me through, as well as, you know, everything we talked about over the past 2 months.
You could argue it's just the right amount of Jason Statham in the movie. Like a drop of the state.
Well, Hobbs and Shaw may argue differently and other films of that ilk. So that gives us an overall score of 5.5625, which is high. It's up there. It's up there. Well, thank you very much, guys. We'll just head to Twitter. And everyone who's listening, do follow us on Twitter. We are at FlixWatcherPod. It's good to follow us anyway because we have a bit of film banter. But generally, before we record, we put a shout out like this. We're reviewing Collateral with at Film Quiz and Drumble. Have you seen it? Tells your thoughts and your score out of 5 stars on a shout out. So you can take part and get your reviews read on this podcast. Like the good people here did. David, do you want to take us off with one of the ones you've seen?
Yes. So my good friend, Liam H. Dempsey from the Spotlight Pod, says, "This is one of man's finest. Its visual style now feels almost completely unique and full of character. Casting Cruise and Fox against type pays off beautifully. Probably the best City at Night movie ever? ! 5 stars.
Simon, do you want to take... I think it's just one more here, isn't there?
So we've got Matt Brothers, who I definitely recognise from the quiz. My favourite man, Slicks at Spencil, would a brilliant against type Cruise. Wish he'd play more baddies. I don't disagree with that, as I've said several times.
Totally second that.
Massive Cruise fan, but I mean, quality and quantity. I'm sure if he played more baddies, they'd all be awesome.
If he just played this one baddie, it's still just a gift.
And I did nudge him to say, ask how many stars, and he came back with 5 stars. Simon and David, can you tell us where people can find you online and say goodbye to everyone who's listening?
Well, you can find me at drumble. On Twitter, and sometimes I talk about my job in animation, but mostly I just flirt with my film podcast friends. So I look forward to flirting more with FlixWatcher and Bigger Boat in the future.
Simon?
You can find me on Twitter at @film_quiz. Me and my colleague Lee J, we both produce and host the quiz when it happens, but I do most of the tweeting. So yeah, hope to see you on there.
Thank you very much, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely.
Cheers. Great fun. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell him FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.